I was clinging to music as sanity for myself. And so I had a really hard time playing in front of people because music was my method of medicine for my brain. And so if I played in front of someone, it felt like inviting people to a heart surgery.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile. This is Premier Christian Radio and I'm Emma Fowle. The Profile is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Head over to premierchristianity.com/podcast for your exclusive half-price subscription offer. Today on The Profile, I'm joined by Amanda Cook, the ex-Bethel singer-songwriter best known for hits such as You Make Me Brave. In this fascinating interview, we discuss her ADHD diagnosis, growing into your calling, and why Cook will never be comfortable being called a worship leader.
Thank you so much for joining us on The Profile today, Amanda. It's a real pleasure to have you with us.
It's a joy.
Can we start by just asking you to tell us a little bit about your story? How did you grow up? Did you grow up in a Christian home?
I grew up in the center of Canada, in Manitoba, on a farm. The daughter of grain farmers. Faith kind of came with the territory, and it was very practical in the way that I got to witness my family be at the mercy of something that was outside of their control consistently, which was the weather. So it gave me a framework for faith and for the idea of God that made sense, I guess, in some ways to me, to be put in touch with our limits as humans, and that there's something beyond, like, wherever my limits end, there's something past that, and there's very little that I actually can control. There's so much that's outside of my control. So what is the ecosystem that I am in charge of, that I want to nurture, which is an inner world? And because where I grew up, it's winter 6 months of the year. If you didn't have an inner world that you were developing, you would perish, essentially, because we had to have an inner world activity. So music became essential. Reading, you know, was essential. Just storytelling. My dad reading us novels by the fire. That it's very, very certain.
Sounds
painting
beautiful.
A really picturesque version of this, but there's, like, you know, there's this harsh winter happening outside, and then there's this, it was like a physical, you know, tangible idea for me when thinking about the inner spaciousness and the inner temple, that there can be this harsh reality out here, and there can also be a warmth in here. And so I got to see kind of the extremes of the spectrum, I guess. And then faith was very much, it was a practical thing that I got to see my dad return to when he would pick up his guitar on Sunday morning and sing songs. It felt like a result of the practice of his faith during the week, not the pinnacle, if that makes sense. It was like a remembrance. I'm going to remember these things because, you know, music has muscle memory and it remembers things that I forget. And so I got to be put in this pattern and this ritual, this rhythm of daily living and being in the elements, learning an inner world system, and then music as a pathway, as a map to be able to articulate the things that felt, you know, beyond, the things that felt too big for our bodies, the things that felt, you know, whether it's feast or famine. I got to watch my family gather around, you know, the idea of the goodness of God and wrestle with it, because it wasn't just, I mean, it's not, I've painted a really serene picture of it. My brother, if he ever listens to this, will have a good laugh because he's taking over the family farm. And it is hard work. It's intense and the days are long and he shoulders it. And yeah, but I think it gave me the framework that I go back to the most.
Yeah.
And you're 40. Yeah.
You're right, aren't you? Because we're here in Cornwall today, Creation Fest. We're in a beautiful agricultural site. We're surrounded by farmlands. I know lots of them personally. Anyone will tell you being a farmer is an act of faith in and of itself.
So,
you know, like you say, that's a really good testing ground to actually not just think about the things of faith as abstract ideas, but to have to really trust in the God that provides for you when things are outside of your control, or you're battling weather, or crops are failing, or animals are dying, or other things, you know.
Yes.
They always say that farm kids grow up knowing life and death in all its goodness and glory, like very early on. Oh, was that your experience?
Yes, yeah. Of all the animals that I love dearly, I feel like farm kids get really well acquainted with the brevity of things and life and death, and also the pattern of life and death, the pattern of the seasons. I really loved growing up in four full seasons to be able to see really clearly how bleak it feels when the snow actually melts right before the spring, and then suddenly everything is in bloom and it's all green and lush. Being able to read scripture that talked about seasons and sowing and reaping and farming, a lot of agriculture in the scriptures, it helped me with, well, this is what we're doing, you know, this is just a part of our daily life and livelihood, you know.
Was there a point for you as a child or a young teenager where that became, you know, was there that point where it was, this is not just my family's faith, this was mine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably everybody has the pivotal, I think, moments where we start to split off from, not even split off, but differentiate from what someone else's faith is, be it parents, friends, teachers, whatever we're surrounded by. So I, there were all these moments, I think, as in development that we get to go, is this what I think? Do I actually have enough evidence for it? Our brains are always looking for evidence to believe whatever it is that we already believe. And whatever we believe is determined by the time we're 12, really. Like, we absorb it more than we're taught it. We absorb it from our family culture. So probably the classic, you know, my adolescence was when I started to wonder things on my own, and I've always been a curious person. I've always been led by curiosity. I want to know how things work and why, you know, just, it's classic. I think we all have that innate curiosity. And then there have been different markers along the path as we start to embrace the existential loneliness of our own particular path, which we all have. Then there's moments where I've revisited what stays, what is the center that still holds? Is there a center that still holds? And what are the things that have maybe led me to this point as a survival skill, as a part of my faith, that now I can either trade for something else, like certainty, the idea of certainty. I've traded a lot of certainty for trust, I would say. I trust Jesus more now than I think I ever have, but I'm uncertain, and I've traded this certainty, the things that I thought I needed to collect in order to have faith, to be certain of the mental, I guess, mapping and fortitude of like propping my faith up with enough good thoughts. I've traded a lot of that idea for actually trusting in the nature and the person and the presence of Jesus. That makes sense. So there's, I have more reassurance than I ever have. But it's not in my ability to hold on to my own faith. It's in his ability to lead me and to cut through the vitriol in my own mind and to cut through the noise and, with peace. I know that voice. I forget what it sounds like sometimes, but then it'll catch me, you know, by surprise or catch me off guard when I least expect it. And it reroutes everything. It recenters everything. It brings us back, brings me back to the center that still holds. So I've had markers and catalysts all along the way of moments where, like, you know, there's a crack in the very neatly and in the neat and tidy version of survival and control that we build in order to survive, right? Something happens outside of that and it blows the whole thing open, and that's when we get to look at, what do I believe about this? Do I believe this? Is this my mother's faith? Is this mine? Is this, what is this? And so we all have those catalysts, and I've had some, you know, my own catalysts all along the way that have introduced me to a more expanded viewpoint of God holding this whole thing together and the more personal Jesus than I ever knew before. Because before I was, you know, it was mostly ideas about him that I was projecting on him or to him. Now I'm like, oh, you can actually tell me who you are. Yeah. Rather than, you know, you're really good at telling and actually introducing yourself. So
do you think that's a structure that like exists within the church that we sort of, I don't know, either willingly or unwillingly have created this sort of thing where, you know, especially if you grow up in the church, there's this very fixed idea about who Jesus is, mm-hmm. who God is, what mm-hmm. faith looks like. Mm-hmm. And when that starts to shake a little bit, it can be really unsettling, can't mm-hmm. it? And you've talked quite a lot about your own journey through those wrestles. What did that look like for you?
Mm. That's an interesting point of view, and my mind was going while you were talking about that, mm. about the interpretations. We're all like kind of these interpreters. We're living in the mystery of it and the clarity of it, and then we're interpreting it to people through sharing, right? Mm. Yeah. Can you narrow the field just a little bit for me?
Yeah. Like, I wonder if, I mean, I think it's probably different in different church traditions, mm. isn't it? I think some churches are better at mm. holding a more flexible space uh-huh. for faith. Uh-huh. And I was just wondering what it was like in your church tradition growing up. Mm. Did you grow up in a church tradition that had a very fixed idea of what faith mm. should and or shouldn't look like? And how did that yeah. help or hinder you as you went through life?
Definitely both. Definitely yes and definitely. it's funny, like we all find this moment with God, and then we build a monument around it, and then that can help and both hinder, right? Mm. It's like if it's a monument, it's meant to be beheld and studied and impact. I've felt the impact of so many monuments, you know, so many denominations, so many viewpoints of the same thing. But it's like walking around a tree. Or there's this old story of like, I'm going to get it wrong. I'm just going to use the tree as an example.
Yeah.
Because it's, if we all just park ourselves at one point of the tree and just have this laser focus on like a particular, you know, branch, we think the whole tree is that branch. But we need to be able to zoom out a little bit and see the tree as a whole, and then zoom back in, and then zoom out, and zoom back in, and zoom out. And so I think that's what I've ended up following a lot more, is an ecumenical, pathway mm-hmm. of exploring the many different ways of looking at the same thing, taking a walk around it. But it definitely, it helped, and all of them help and hinder. They all have like a gift and also an impairment if we get stuck, you know? And I think sometimes we need to stop and stay at a vista for long enough for it to actually, you know, become part of the landscape, you know, of faith. I needed to put myself into situations and places that were wildly outside of my paradigm. I didn't grow up in a charismatic environment mm. at all. And so going to a place like Bethel for a number of years was deeply confronting and challenging for me, but also wildly freeing, because it introduced me to a different perspective, a different way of interacting with God. You know, I grew up in a culture that like dancing really wasn't part of the landscape. And so being able to be in a space where we could use our whole being to express mm-hmm. prayer, our whole being to express, you know, our conversation, our whole being to express communion, was incredible to me. And to be able to use music, to be able to be in the path of music in a space where we could explore and we could be curious with music, we could go down these different, you know, pathways together with friends. It was like I found this little pocket of people that were, you know, running towards, you know, the same thing, it felt like. So I needed that. And then I also need liturgy. I came out to England, I guess almost 10 years ago, but I spent a lot of concentrated time here in 2018 because I was going through my own, another catalyst, towards grief. It was the introduction to grief, which was an introduction to grace, an introduction to God. And I needed to be in a spacious place with, you know, nature and rolling hills and quiet. And I needed the whole thing to be quiet because my nervous system in grief, your nervous system is just like heightened. And so I couldn't put myself in loud environments, like I, you know, environments that I still do love, but I, my nervous system needed to just be in some rolling hills and going on long walks and listening to birds and meeting God in that sort of way. And in this little chapel in West Sussex, you know, that I love dearly, and sitting in a chapel that's older than America was enough. You know what I mean? I was being introduced to a deeper well and a faith tradition that was holding me more than me holding onto it. That's what it felt like.
It's amazing, because I think the temptation is often when we look at people on a stage leading worship, when, you know, people might have been at a big church a couple of months ago and seen you there, or, you know, seen you on the internet, they see Amanda Cook, the worship leader, you've been at Bethel, you're a big name. And I think the temptation is for us to assume that people like that, in inverted commas, have never been through any trauma or any grief or struggle with anything, and you have this easy faith that allows you to minister to thousands of people, and it's all, you know, very, oh, well, this must be the stuff that they find really easy and enjoy all the time. And I know it's, you know, if we think about it logically, we know that's not true. No human operates like that. Then. But would you talk to us a little bit about what that experience has been like for you as an inverted commas famous worship leader? Mm. What does it feel like for you when you're on a stage? Is it always a joyful, deep connection with God? Or are there times when you're struggling with it? And how do you deal with those times?
I think there's like three. I'm going to break it down into three sections, because they don't feel like one and the same to me. Mm-hmm. I have always loved music, and I've loved music as a map and as a path towards connection, towards prayer, towards the divine, towards people. I love how it connects us. And growing up, I didn't know titles of things, like even worship leading. Like, to me, those words felt like very heavy. And I used to wonder, was it because I just didn't want the responsibility? I'm afraid of responsibility. And I now am just, you know, learning to unpack, I guess, more playfully what I feel, I guess, the thing is that I want to give back to people and to the church at large, which is, an artist's perspective. It's to be an artist that deeply loves and cares for people, and deeply loves and cares for music, deeply loves and cares for the church, gathering people to sing and to be in the tradition of prayer and returning to the center. But when it comes to playing music in front of people, that was never the goal. I always struggled with that. This is a personal struggle. It's a neurodivergent struggle too. Music was my only medicine for my particular brand of disorder in my mind for most of my life until 2 years ago. And I had a late diagnosis of ADHD, which often happens. That's a whole other podcast, but for women, especially in our, you know, later on in life is when the diagnosis usually happens. So I've finally started to feel like, is this what life can be like? Mm-hmm. If music is not just medicine, because I was clinging to music as sanity for myself, what else could it be, you know? And so I had a really hard time playing in front of people, because music was my method of medicine for my brain. And so if I played in front of someone, it felt like I was letting them watch me self-regulate. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt like inviting, I've talked about this a bit, but it keeps coming back, because I'm like, it felt like inviting people to a heart surgery. Like, everybody just come watch this. Yeah. It didn't feel like, I've got something I want to share with you. It felt like, I'm going to play for my own sanity, and I guess all these people are coming with me. And I didn't know how to differentiate or even how to get on my front foot with that, because I think there is a gift in the innate vulnerability of artistry. It's kind of like any artist worth their salt has, like, it's a felt thing. It's a human thing. We feel that connection. So we feel the connection to the wrestle and to the struggle that people that artists have, and that they work out on the page or in their painting or in their music and whatever their artistry is, right? But I always felt on my back foot with that, because I felt like I was learning in real time how I felt while everyone else was. And that just didn't feel safe, psychologically safe for me. So over the last couple of years, and I mean, I've been in therapy for a number of years too, and that's been immensely helpful to be able to now create a space that feels psychologically, like in a psycho-spiritual way, safe for me to actually share something that feels like a gift to people, not just medicine for me, if that makes sense. And it still is medicine. It absolutely is. It hasn't lost that. It just feels like now I actually am able to share. I'm moving into a different space of being able to share something that I really do love, and embrace the cost of being in a room with people, you know, the variables of all of that, you know, all the energy, if you put 100 people in a room, there's so much energy in that. And so learning how to differentiate, learning how to create a space with music for people to have their own experience with God, because that's my goal too, is not so much to tell people what to think at all. It's to create a soundtrack that brings enough clarity. It does the thing that it does for my own mind, where it brings me to a clear thought. And that is the space then. It's a God space. It's always felt like a miracle to me. I long to be able to create stillness and space for people to have their own clarity of thought and to be able to have their own inner world prayer with God, if that makes sense. That has been the goal, and that continues to be the goal for me, is to get to that kind of place of solitude through the anxiety and through all of the different things that we come into a room with, that I come into a room with.
And is that because that feels like quite hard for you at times?
Yeah.
So you're this is what I want, and this is how I feel better, and now I'm just sharing it with all of you guys.
Yeah. It's impossible without the help that I have. And now it's starting to feel more like I'm going to invite people into the things that I do in my own home, burning incense, reading something, playing, like very simple, tactile things. And that is, in essence, what's ironic. It's like we started talking about worship leading. That is a sense. There's a sense of worship leading in that. I think for me, what I've had a hard time with is that my brain looks for what the example is of whatever the thing, the title is, and the definition. Like if you put worship leader on Wikipedia, what comes up? And then we're really quick to just build methods and forms of things. You know what I mean? When really, I think there, as far as whatever leadership is going to look like in my life and worship is going to look like in my life, it's going to be bespoke. It's going to funnel through the way that I'm actually wired, and it's going to be a different kind of leading, you know, than maybe what is expected out here. I have less and less to say about what anybody else does, because it's my own transformation is a full-time job. So I'm in the cheap seats of anybody else's choices, lives, you know, wrestles. I'm in my own. That's my full-time job. And to embrace that and then to put that through the alchemy of artistry is the goal, so that it becomes an actual act of public service, you know, hopefully more and more void of my ego. Like, you know, that goes with me everywhere, but that would be the goal.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
It sounds like you've spent quite a long time sort of thinking all of this stuff through. Do you feel comfortable with the label worship leader now? How would you describe yourself and what you do?
I don't know if I'll ever feel comfortable with that.
Do you feel called to it?
I feel compelled, and I've always felt drawn to the final frontier of God, to the clarity of Jesus, and to the map of music. And so those things put together, if worship leading is like the easiest way to access that, as far as understanding is concerned, then I can I can meet that there. I think just with as far as will I ever be comfortable with it. What gets tricky for me is that I am not a theologian. I did not go to school for that. I went to school for music. I studied music. I trust that. That's where I put my 10,000 hours in. So I want to offer that. And I want to offer what I study through that and what I learn through that in music. But I have a deep reverence for education as well. And I love learning. And so I feel hesitant to put myself forward as a certain kind of representative. And I feel hesitant about being the face of a brand of God, I guess. I love Jesus. I'm a follower of Jesus. And that that's a lifelong thing that's unfolding for me, whether or not I'm playing music in front of people or not. That doesn't go anywhere. That's the real life, right? Mm. So that's a great question. I don't think I've ever actually been asked that question before. Mm. And I think as far as what I feel pulled towards and continually like following the little silver thread, following the glimmers and the bread, like those moments, it's that I love art. I love artistry. And I want to be an artist that extends that love towards people in any environment. And I love my faith tradition. I'm grateful for it. So that's always going to be a center, like the center point of the whole thing for me.
You said you studied music. Did you grow up thinking, I want to be a recording artist, or was the plan always to go to a massive mega church like Bethel and lead worship and become famous? Or how did that happen?
Not at all. The earliest childhood dream that I can remember probably would be, I always knew it was music. I wanted to make music. Performing music was, it felt like just what was offered. It was like the next step. So I just kind of took whatever the next step was. Music created, and it still does, it created the next step. So I followed kind of that, the road as it unfolded. I think the thing is, I didn't have a defined idea. And growing up in Canada too, worship leading, quote unquote, isn't a career path for anybody. It's not a genre of music, worship music. You know what I mean? It's a way of life. And so I think there's a real benefit to not growing up with it being decided and defined like that. Because I remember I knew it was always music. My parents put me in piano lessons when I was like 4, and my first piano teacher, her name is Jane, and I adore her. She led worship, led music at a church in the city, and we would go to those gatherings, and they were gatherings of multi-churches, which was really important now looking back, especially with the path of like the ecumenical path that I'm on. But I remember being in those environments and seeing and feeling that, and I didn't have language for it then either. And I'm glad my parents weren't quick to define it, but it was this idea of whatever this is, I would like to be part of it. It's this feeling of prayer and exploration and curiosity and Jesus, like having the compass and the clarity of Jesus, music as the soundtrack for that. And it, actually was an ecumenical environment that I was the most impacted by, where there was different ideas, different people, you know, staring at the same thing. So, yeah, I think I always wanted to make music. I love being in the studio. I probably will make music one way or another until I die, but it might not be, you know, what I'm doing now. It can evolve, it can change, you know.
And yeah. It sounds like now you're at a place where you're much more comfortable with actually, this is what I want to do, this is who I am, this is how I see my faith, this is how I see this stuff.
Starting to, yeah. I mean, I heard the rumors of becoming older about being a woman and getting older and how we actually start really embodying what our path is, without apologizing and fawning and over-explaining ourselves constantly, which is what, you know, that's a method of survival. I think so.
I think that's a really interesting point. I am a journalist. I only went back to do my master's at 37.
Wow.
Even though I wanted to be a journalist at 16 and I knew I did, I just didn't quite have the confidence. And then the careers lady told me to do something more sensible. You know, that kind of journey? So I really do. And you hear this a lot from women. So I don't want to generalize for everybody, but I do think it is a thing that sometimes for some women, it takes us a little longer to find our voice and find the place where you're like, actually, no, this is what I want. Yes. I don't want to just keep doing the thing that I've been told I need to do.
Yes.
And getting to a point where you feel comfortable. And as you mentioned earlier, part of that for you was a late life diagnosis with ADHD.
Yeah.
How has that impacted you?
It's immense.
Do you mind talking about
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm trying to decide what to say about it.
There's so much.
There is that wash of relief and then 38 years of grief, of not knowing what I was wrestling with. And mental health is just so fascinating because we walk around assuming everyone's brains work the same, right? So I was comparing myself consistently to neurotypical environments and people who could get a lot done in a day and stay focused and wake up with dopamine at 7 a.m. I mean, I just didn't know a day like that until I actually got on medication. And there's, you know, millions of miracles out there. And right now, one of them for me is medication. I the help combined with everything else, combined with all the practices, it was a missing piece for me because I had these practices of gratitude journaling, morning pages, therapy, walking, nutrition, hydration, all these things, but they were all there to keep me from drowning for the day. So there's very little that you can actually get done when you're just trying to keep your head above water. Mm. And hard to explain because you don't have any energy to explain it to anyone. And it just feels like I'm doing nothing. It feels like I'm lazy. It feels like all I know is procrastination and time blindness. And it's very debilitating. And then the rest of the day is spent recovering from my own mind. So it's all happening internally. Mm. It's really hard to articulate. I didn't have language for it growing up. I mean, it was the 90s. When I was growing up, we weren't talking like this, especially where I come from. And ADHD was largely, you know, considered to be a hyperactive. It plays out differently in little boys, right?
Yeah, naughty boys.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to go like, wait, I can have a clear thought, a concise thought. I can follow through on something. I can stay and focus. And that was also a real issue for me with playing music in front of people because I can forget where I am, what I'm doing very quickly, and including being on stage. And like suddenly I'm thinking about something else. Suddenly I'm thinking about what I want to eat after. Suddenly I don't remember lyrics. You know, there's just all these things that were factors that I was like, if I'm putting myself in that position, it feels like pain to me. It actually doesn't, there's not a lot of payoff, really.
And you're too busy worrying about getting it all
Absolutely.
Right. But you're also meant to be ministering to people and ushering into the presence of God and all of those things. It's a lot.
And there would always be this pocket of clarity because music always created that for me. So there would always be a reason to come back, even if it was like 3 seconds long. And I'd be like, okay, that 3 seconds made a huge difference. Having like all these different pieces that are helping me now. And even just the piece of medication, having that piece as a part of the whole picture helps my mind to be able to retain information. It helps all the other practices, all the other things that I still do, gratitude journaling, walking, morning pages, therapy, all those things are still in place. There's no magic pill for any life. You know, it helps my brain slow down enough to be able to be present, enough to actually live and make decisions from a different place, from a front foot place.
Does it make a difference in church for people who struggle with ADHD or neurodiverse? What's your experience of that being like? What would you like the church to do differently?
Oh, man.
Too many things.
I think just maybe the recognition of everyone is wired differently and our needs are different. Especially since we've moved church environments into, I don't want to say this across the board because I go to basilicas, I go to Catholic churches that have their doors open and I walk in and I feel this sentience of prayer and this stillness of peace. People know what to do. Like it's when you're in Europe and you walk into a church, you know, we're looking for solitude. We're looking for peace. And so to just sit, light a candle and sit and be, I mean, that simmering presence to me is, I mean, it's a recipe for, if there was a recipe, but there's, it's like this, yeah, it's a recipe for peace to walk in. And I have these memories seared into my brain of moments when I was grieving or needed to let go of something or wrestling with something. And I would just walk in and sit down, light a candle and breathe. And there's so much happened in my interior world in that moment in a half hour. Nobody told me what to think. Nobody invited me to a small group. Nobody tried to get me to sign up for a list. I'm not bad mouthing any of those things. I think those are all attempts at connection with people at the end of the day, but and the church's people. But I think especially for people, you know, who have, for me, it always felt like my nervous system lived about a foot outside my body. And it didn't make sense to me when I was told, like, oh, you're just too sensitive. You need to toughen up a bit. And so I would try to dampen it, but it didn't make any sense to me. I just didn't understand. I was like, why does everything feel so, like, animated and electric? Like, the energy out here is palpable. And so going into any loud environment, be it a show or a concert or a crowd or a church, because we a lot of churches present in that sort of way now, it's just overstimulating to the max and overwhelming. And sometimes I just need to take myself out of the environment and go sit in a quiet space and regroup and then come back in. That's all right. I think just learning how to be compassionate with that and not, again, we're in the cheap seats of everybody else's experience. So learning my own is that's the job. That's the work that I'm doing, not judging anybody else. You don't have time to judge anybody else's when you're doing your own work. So I think as far as creating places of stillness, places of peace, well, my friend Toby Thomas was telling me a few weeks ago, it was so fascinating. He said in the 80s, the church's response to apathy was to make church more exciting. And now we're paying for that with our anxiety because the noise threshold is so high. So we're like, it's like we're trying to be more noisy than the noise when really like stillness and peace is actually the most contrasting thing that there is when it comes to noise.
Yeah, I was just thinking like it is an interesting reflection, isn't it? Because for the whole of church history, basically, like you said, we had these beautiful temples of peace and still and quiet, and like you say, you go into any of the old churches, you walk through the door, and it's just this echo.
Yeah,
there's just something very still and beautiful about it. And the sort of the noisy, charismatic, loud evangelical stuff is a relatively modern phenomenon in that vast sort of 2,000-year history, isn't it? So, and that's what I was just turning that over in my brain as you were speaking, because I was thinking, oh, that's actually really interesting, and we've done that because at some point we obviously felt we needed to be more upbeat or relevant.
And even just competing with culture rather than being comfortable with the uncomfortability of something just being different, like a pocket of stillness in the middle of a very busy world. I think leadership, as far as leadership is concerned, whatever energy we're in, if I'm in my anxious energy, I'll lead people through anxiety, like with anxiety. If I'm in my peace, then I can offer something different and I can let people be okay with walking out. I think that's part of it too. We just have gotten so afraid of quote unquote losing people or losing people's attention or what. So we try to keep it really exciting, like the 2-second thing that we scroll through on Instagram. And I'm like, no, the human heart actually is made for a more expanded view. And it's actually, we know what to do. That's the thing. Anytime I go into a church like that in Europe, I'm like, all these visitors from all around the world, we all know what we're here for. We all are looking for stillness. We're all looking for that kind of peace. And it's readily available. And it's deeply uncomfortable to embrace that, I think, in our presentations currently in a certain sort of space. This isn't the church as a whole. And everything serves a purpose. I'm not tearing one thing down to elevate another thing. I think all of these eras and different versions of things have served purposes and met people where they need to be met. I just think the human longing wins in the end, and where our longing is for a complete, a holistic picture of faith that we practice in daily ways, in our normal lives, in ordinary interactions and conversations, and it's through the 5 senses. You know, I love lighting incense now. To me, that's just, it's all part of worship. And scent is memory. So it brings me back to center. That's something that just actually focuses me in prayer too. It's funny, when you let things move towards stillness, you can feel the elasticity of who's the most anxious right now. Is it the church leader? Are we just going to run with, you know, all the programs that we know how to do, because it's good to have things to rely on and fall back on. It's really important. Mm. It's good. It's stabilizing. That's why I love the Book of Common Prayer. That's why we love the Psalms, things to fall back on, things that have been prayed for centuries before we showed up and will continue to be prayed after we leave. I love those things. But yeah, what do we do when there's a silent moment? Are we able to hold space for each other? Are we able to hold space for God to speak, you know?
I think that actually is very challenging for a lot of church leaders, Extremely. Isn't it? I find that really hard when I have to lead like little services at our local church. Like, I would much rather fill the time. Yes. And I would do that, you know, on a personal level, if we're chatting. I'm really, really bad at just relaxing into the silence. And I think that's the problem, isn't it? Quite often we fill the gaps and we don't leave the space for God to do what God wants to do and to meet with people individually. And I wonder if that's just a little bit of a rabbit hole that we've got lost within the church structures that we're in at the moment. Mm-hmm. I found it really fascinating watching what was happening at Asbury University last year, and hearing the reports that were coming back from that of the leaders saying what was so beautiful was that it was completely unscheduled. There was no one of any profile or significance on the stage. The time that was taken backstage to consecrate themselves before leading people in, and just that the weight of God's presence just really taking control of the agenda. And that's really something that I'm quite interested in thinking about at the moment. Were you at Asbury? Did you go?
I wasn't.
No. Mm-mm. How do you but you get to travel to lots of different places and experience lots of different sorts of church movements. What do you feel is happening? Do you have a sense of something that God's doing or moving or shaking within the church as you travel around and you see stuff?
I always feel perplexed by big questions like that.
Yeah, me too. That's a horrible one.
No, it's really good. I do have thoughts, and they're probably going to be the most unsexy thoughts.
That's okay.
I do have thoughts. I think, because life moves in themes, and the theme, I'd say that there are several themes that I'm in right now, and one of the themes is especially within mental health, compulsion towards obsession has always been motivated by trying to eclipse the overwhelm in my brain. And so I can obsess about anything. I can hyperfixate on anything. It's a matter of my brain looking for something to like sink its teeth into to give it a moment's relief from how overwhelmed it feels. And so I can obsess about anything from a skincare routine to a color to a person to God, right? It's less about the actual object and it's more about the obsessing. And so learning that actually was really incredible for in the faith context, because I had limited, and I never knew, I mean, we don't know until we know, but I didn't realize I had been limiting the idea of God to an obsession, to in the moments where my brain is eclipsing the overwhelm by obsessing about God, which is an amazing thing to obsess about. I had limited my view to that is when God was with me. Those pinnacle moments, those like vistas, which is true. Absolutely. What's beautiful about this is that I had this, I guess, I don't know if it was an aha moment or an epiphany recently, where I was seeing almost like a reel of all these moments that I was like, well, that's when I knew God was there. That's when I knew God was there. That's when my brain clocked in. That's when I felt that moment. And all of them count. But I felt like I was watching them with the presence of Jesus in the ordinary, sitting with me, right? That like we think this is the moment God is with us, when God actually promised to be with us always. And actually healing to me feels like not needing to hyperfixate, not needing to obsess. It actually feels like being able to be in the ordinary day to day and stay in that kind of simple space. I believe I met and we meet God on pilgrimages, right? A lot of that has to do with the fact that we are willing to step outside of our daily normal activities to meet God. God is so good at meeting us in any sort of way, shape, or form, wherever we're meant to be met. Whatever we're looking for, we're ultimately going to find it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So my motivation of looking for God often was motivated out of the anxiety of missing out and needing an obsession to eclipse the overwhelm in my brain. Those are beautiful things, actually, because my brain was helping me survive.
Mm-hmm.
And God is a magnificent thing to help us survive. It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
Like to see it through the lens of compassion and deep acceptance of what is incredible.
Do you think it's hard? Is it hard to hold on to that sense of intimate relationship with God when you are a Christian worship leader, a Christian who has platform, who has profile, who's traveling a lot, who's on big stages a lot of the time? Does it become difficult to maintain that sense of like I'm just a normal, quote unquote, normal Christian with my own personal relationship with God when you're so out there all the time and people are projecting things on you probably and expecting things of you and you're out on big stages?
I think one of my friends recently said, it was really interesting, he was talking about how you can confuse momentum with grace and they're not the same things. That was really striking to me. I don't even have a follow-up thought to that because it was really striking and I've been pondering it ever since. But I think just staying in the daily, grace is a daily thing. I future trip a lot, which is where there's a lot of anxiety, but staying in the daily measure of whatever today brings, which sometimes can look like the elasticity of expanding and letting, you know, a bunch of people into a certain kind of space and serving that space and creating space with music and soundtrack. And then other days are just completely opposite from that or very different from that. So it's kind of more of this, like, I guess, yeah, opening and not closing, but just sharing and then retreating and sharing, retreating, that kind of thing. Yeah. I have great hope in the psycho-spiritual imagination of people and the longing that we have for the true Jesus and for the true center of the affection of God that still holds and will still hold no matter what.
Amazing.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.